Good day, this is Mary reading Newsmax for the Talking Information Centre. It is August 24th of 2026. And first story up is, Iran's speaker warns, we are hungry, we cannot survive. Okay. Iran's parliament speaker has issued an unusually stark warning about the country's deepening economic troubles, declaring that even a powerful military cannot protect the Islamic Republic if its people are hungry and the economy continues to deteriorate. Mohammad Baghir Qulibaf, one of the country's most senior political figures, made the comments during a meeting with Iranian and Iraqi economists in Baghdad, according to Middle East news outlet Al Bawaba. No matter how strong our military power becomes, if we are hungry, we will not be able to endure, Qulibaf warned, according to the report. The comments represent a striking acknowledgement from inside Iran's leadership that the country's economic crisis could threaten its ability to maintain national security and political stability. Qulibaf said military power cannot be separated from economic strength, describing security and the economy as two wings that depend upon one another. Without security, he said, investors will not risk their capital. But without economic growth, domestic production, and sufficient income for ordinary citizens, the government cannot sustain security indefinitely. His comments come as Iran continues to face severe economic pressures after years of international sanctions, regional conflict, and enormous government expenditures on its military and regional allies. Iran's inflation has been reported at about 90%, while GDP has contracted sharply. More than 1 million jobs have been lost, and oil exports are now close to zero because of the US naval blockade. Meanwhile, Iran continues to invest heavily in ballistic missiles, drones, and other weapons, while also supporting armed groups and allies across the Middle East. Qulibaf's remarks suggest Iranian leaders are increasingly concerned that military capabilities offer little protection against growing economic hardship at home. We are hungry, we cannot survive, news outlet Al Bawaba summarized Qulibaf's warning in its headline Saturday. Qulibaf, a former commander in Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, has long been considered a major figure in Iran's conservative political establishment. His willingness to publicly link hunger and economic weakness to Iran's national security problems could therefore carry particular significance. The Parliament Speaker emphasized that Iran needs economic growth, investment, financial activity, and increased domestic production if it hopes to remain resilient. His message was straightforward. Missiles and military power alone cannot guarantee the survival of the Iranian state. For Iran to remain strong, Qulibaf said, the government must also provide an economy capable of supporting its people. Without both, he warned, Iran will not be able to endure. And also from Newsmax, Iran TV says kill Barron Trump and claims a $10 million bounty. Iranian media linked to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has escalated its threat against President Donald Trump's family, airing a video on state TV that purportedly tracks the movements of his 20-year-old son, Barron Trump. Separate reports also claim a $10 million bounty has been placed on his head. The video, reported Sunday by news outlet Al Bawaba, appeared on IRGC-linked media and Iran's state-run Channel 3, and carried the title, Where to Kill Barron Trump. According to to Al-Bawaba, the production purported to reveal information about Trump's location and movements, presenting the president's youngest son as being within reach of potential attackers. The outlet also reported claims of a $10 million bounty. The official status of the purported bounty could not immediately be independently confirmed. The latest threat follows an earlier IRGC-linked propaganda campaign against First Lady Melania Trump. In July, the IRGC-affiliated Tasnim News Agency distributed a video titled "Where to Kill Melania" that discussed locations she frequents in New York and her shopping habits. The video alleged details about her Secret Service protection. It encouraged would-be attackers to exploit supposed vulnerabilities. The video concluded with a direct warning to the president's son, "Baron Trump, wait for us." The Secret Service said it was aware of the threatening material and investigates threats against those under its protection. The increasingly personal threats are part of the broader Iranian campaign directed at the president since the outbreak of the U.S.-Iran war. In July, a massive billboard appeared in Tehran's Islamic Revolutionary Square, depicting Donald Trump apparently dead in a coffin. Written prominently across the display in English were the words, "We kill Trump." Other banners reportedly depicted American flag-draped coffins alongside images of the Trump family. Iranian-linked media also previously circulated a video titled "Where to Kill Trump," purporting to map Trump's motorcade routes between airports and his residences in Florida and New York. The Secret Service confirmed it was examining that material. The threats represent a dramatic escalation from Tehran's longstanding vows of retaliation against Donald Trump and former U.S. officials over the 2020 killing of IRGC Quds Force Commander Qasem Soleimani. Also from Newsmax, there is a report of a controversial billionaire broker's Venezuelan oil with Rubio backing. The Trump administration's effort to rebuild Venezuela's shattered oil industry is raising new questions over Washington's reliance on a controversial billionaire who made his fortune under the country's socialist governments. Alejandro Betancourt has faced years of corruption and money laundering allegations. A major investigation published this weekend by the Sunday Times of London reported that the Venezuelan businessman had been picked by Secretary of State Marco Rubio to serve as the key intermediary between the Trump administration and the government of Interim President Delcy Rodriguez. Sources told the newspaper that Betancourt is styling himself as Venezuela's new oil czar, helping Washington negotiate deals and revive oil production after the U.S. removal of Nicolai Maduro in January. The arrangement is particularly striking because Betancourt remains under scrutiny in Europe. The Sunday Times reported the Spanish authorities are investigating allegations involving a $4.3 billion money laundering and tax evasion scheme, while prosecutors in Zurich have examined whether Venezuelan public funds were laundered through European banks. Betancourt has denied wrongdoing and has never been convicted of a crime. He maintains his business activities have been legitimate. Yet, the Trump administrator's willingness to work with him appears to be growing, and Betancourt has become the cornerstone of the Venezuela tragedy. Mauricio Clavo Caron, Rubio's friend and advisor on Venezuela, told Reuters that U.S. officials had used Betancourt as an intermediary because he understood the oil business in both Venezuela and the United States. Bloomberg separately reported Cleaver Caroni helped assemble many of the figures executing Washington's Venezuela tragedy, including Betancourt. Betancourt's history is controversial. He co-founded Derwick Associates, which received about $5 billion in no-bid Venezuelan government power contracts, despite having no previous experience in the sector. Transparency International estimated Derwick overbilled Venezuela by $2.9 billion. Derwick disputed the allegations. Now, critics say another opaque process is emerging around Venezuela's enormously valuable oil fields. Bloomberg reported that in the absence of competitive bidding, Betancourt has gained significant influence over which companies receive opportunities. Preliminary agreements said to be worth in the billions of dollars have gone to American firms that have no experience in oil production or have little public history, including Miami-based Lionheart Capital and California-based Pacific Coast Energy Co., or PCEC. Bloomberg described PCEC as a little-known California-based company that recently signed agreements to operate fields in Lake Maracaibo and the Orinoco Belt. Its investors are not publicly disclosed, although the company says it has financing from banks and trading houses. The forced reshuffle of Venezuela's oil industry, overseen by Cleaver Caron, has also affected established owners of Venezuelan oil interests. Florida energy businessman Harry Sargent III recently sold his minority interest in North American Blue Energy Partners, or NABEP, for $300 million to an undisclosed party reportedly close to Betancourt. LPS reported Sargent sold after significant pressure from the U.S. Treasury to withdraw from the business or suffer official sanctions. Bloomberg reported that shortly after the transaction was signed, Treasury notified Sargent's attorney that it had blocked assets belonging to his offshore holding company. Sargent has insisted his activities as a minority shareholder were always approved by the U.S. government. Reuters subsequently reported Treasury sanctioned Bowaves Properties Limited, a British Virgin Islands company formerly owned by Sargent, that had held the NABEP stake. Another dispute involves the family of the late Venezuelan businessman Oswaldo Cisneros. His heirs allege the Venezuelan government improperly stripped their company, DP Delta Finance BV, of oil drilling rights and operational control worth an estimated $2 billion. Those assets included drilling rights in the oil-rich Orinoco Belt and are now being transferred to PCEC, Bloomberg reported. Venezuelan authorities maintain the venture failed to meet required investment and production commitments. The Cisneros interests are demanding that the assets be restored. The disputes are fueling criticism that Washington may be replacing one opaque Venezuelan oil system with another, while using sanctions and political pressure to influence who owns some of the country's most valuable energy assets. Thor Helfenstein, the Venezuelan-born founder and CEO of the Human Rights Foundation and a longtime Betancourt critic, delivered one of the strongest attacks. The Trump administration at the highest level is well aware of allegations concerning Betancourt's role in Venezuela, Helfenstein told the Sunday Times. He said that if Washington is partnering with him, it would raise serious questions about the complete lack of integrity in Americans' handling of Venezuela. Helveson has previously sued Betancourt and Derwick, alleging bribes were paid to obtain energy contracts. Those lawsuits were dismissed on jurisdictional and or procedural grounds, without courts determining whether the underlying allegations were true. The opaque process surrounding Venezuela's assets and the deal-making involving Alejandro Betancourt continue to fuel concerns about the country's future. Reuters reported in July that Claver Caron, a longtime Rubio ally, was no longer overseeing Venezuelan policy. Claver Caron said he left voluntarily, but multiple sources told Reuters he had effectively been forced out. Although he was a private citizen without a formal government post, officials and business figures describe his extraordinary influence as comparable to a viceroy. The most controversial matter involved Venezuela's enormous sovereign debt restructuring. Reuters reported Claver Caron played a key role in Centerview Partners, winning a contract worth more than $150 million to advise on restructuring roughly $200 billion in Venezuelan debt without a competitive bidding process. He also weighed in on oil transactions and other potentially lucrative commercial decisions. That arrangement raised governance questions because Claver Caroni was exercising influence typically associated with a senior government official while technically remaining a private citizen. Reuters reported that investors and Venezuelan political figures question his apparent ability to act with Washington's blessing despite holding no formal position. Claver Caroni said he had no financial interest in Venezuela or Centerview. The Washington Post had raised similar concerns months earlier. It reported that Claver Caron was effectively helping pick winners and losers among companies seeking access to Venezuela and that he had vouched for Centerview. His business partner, Jessica Bedoya, traveled repeatedly to Caracas and met with Delcy Rodriguez. Bedoya also flew to Venezuela on the same charter as two Centerview executives before the firm secured the restructuring mandate. The selection itself drew complaints from competitors. Lamon reported that Centerview's mandate was awarded without bids and without the IMF playing its traditional role in a restructuring of this magnitude. One rival called the arrangement bizarre and argued that Venezuela was exactly the kind of country where maximum transparency was required. Centerview banker Mathieu Picasse denied that Claver Caron or U.S. officials were involved in securing the mandate. Lamon noted Pegasi's long relationship with Venezuela's socialist leadership, beginning with Hugo Chavez. The Wall Street Journal also reported that Claver Caron's behind-the-scenes support was influential in Centerview's selection. The administration argues its overriding objective is restoring Venezuelan production and bringing American investment back into a country possessing the world's largest proven oil reserves. Trump said shortly after Maduro's removal that major oil companies would invest at least $100 billion. But ExxonMobil's CEO has called Venezuela uninvestable, while other major companies remain cautious about losing billions when their properties were nationalized under Hugo Chavez. That reluctance appears to have increased with Washington's reliance on Betancourt and smaller, less risk-averse companies. The extrajudicial seizure of private assets in Venezuela is also likely to raise questions from outside investors. One U.S. oil industry source summarized the administration's attitude to the Sunday Times. "We just want this. We just want to get this done. We just want to sign the deals, and we just want to see the oil flowing. But with valuable assets changing hands, companies losing concessions, and the businessman with a long history of investigations emerging as one of Washington's most influential intermediaries, critics are demanding greater transparency about who will control Venezuela's post-Maduro oil industry and how those parties were chosen." Also from Newsmax, Sean Grayson, the former Illinois sheriff's deputy, convicted of fatally shooting Sonia Massey in her home in 2024, died Sunday while serving a 20-year prison sentence, his attorney said. Grayson, 32, died around noon, attorney Daniel L. Fultz confirmed. He had served about 6 months of his sentence for second-degree murder. Grayson had been battling stage 4 colon cancer, though his cause of death was not immediately clear. He was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer in 2023 before it had spread to his liver, lungs, and rectum. Defense attorney Mark Wyckoff said during Grayson's sentencing in January, the Illinois Prisoner Review Board denied Grayson's request for medical release in July despite his advanced cancer. A jury convicted Grayson in October in the killing of Massey, 36, who had called police in July of 2024 to report a possible prowler outside her Springfield area home. Grayson, then a Sangamon County Sheriff's deputy and another officer, responded to the call. The encounter turned deadly inside Massey's home after she approached a pot of hot water on her stove and told the officers, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus." Body camera footage from Grayson's partner showed Grayson drawing his gun and threatening to shoot Massey in the face before ordering her to drop the pot. Massey apologized and ducked before Grayson fired 3 shots, prosecutors said at the trial. She died from a gunshot wound. Grayson's body camera has not been activated for most of the encounter, but was turned on shortly after he drew his weapon. His former partner, Dawson Farley, testified at a trial that he did not view Massey as a threat. Farley said he was confused by Massey's religious remark, but never felt endangered by her, and drew his own weapon only after Grayson did. Grayson was sentenced in January to 20 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections, to be followed by 2 years of mandatory supervised release. And also from Newsmax, Ukraine wants peace, but will not just give in to Russia at any price, President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a defiant speech on Monday, as foreign leaders gathered in Kiev to mark its Independence Day celebrations. Prime Minister Andy Burnham and European Council President Antonio Costa were among the foreign dignitaries present for celebrations of the 31st anniversary of Ukraine's break from the Soviet Union. Burnham, making his first visit to the Ukrainian capital as Prime Minister, was due to announce British support to help Kiev boost its domestic production of long-range missiles. He was also scheduled to co-chair a virtual meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, a group of countries backing Ukraine, with French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. The leaders were expected to discuss Ukraine's request for more air defense systems to stop Russia ballistic missiles pounding Ukrainian cities. wearing a traditional Ukrainian embroidered shirt. Zelensky thanked foreign leaders from Finland, Denmark, Norway, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia for traveling to Kiev to show their support. He vowed to find a solution to what he called Russian President Vladimir Putin's ballistic terror. Ukraine absolutely wants peace, but it is not ready to simply surrender, Zelensky said in a video posted on Telegram, which showed him standing in front of the golden-domed St. Michael's Monastery. Zelensky said that Russia's demand, repeatedly rejected by Ukraine, that Kiev cede the remaining part of the eastern Donbass area that is not in Russian hands after 4.5 years of war would not be enough to stop Russian aggression. All of this is driven by the maniac dream of one person that Ukraine should not exist, Zelensky said. In a reference to Putin, the Kremlin is obsessed with this. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, and swathes of Ukrainian territory have been laid waste since Russia launched its full-scale invasion in February 24th, 2022. US-led peace talks to bring a lasting end to the war stalled as Ukraine refused Russian demands to cede more territory, and fighting continues along a 750-mile front line. Zelensky highlighted the achievements of the Ukraine's defense industry during the war, including strikes with its naval drones and mid- and long-range strikes deep inside Russia, but said there was no more work to do. He urged Ukrainian arms manufacturer Firepoint to accelerate production of its Flamingo cruise missile to take the fight to Russia this winter. Burnham signaled on Monday he would allow the use of classified British technology for Kiev to start production of European Scalp long-range missile cruise missiles by Ukraine. The Kremlin said the use of classified British technology would add fuel to the fire, and has warned London of consequences for supplying drones to Kiev. Russia's advances on the battlefield have slowed this year, and Ukraine has recaptured some land in the southeast. But Moscow forces are threatening the strategic eastern city of Kostyantynivka in the eastern region of Donetsk, which forms part of Donbass, together with the Luhansk region. Exploiting Ukraine's critical shortage of anti-ballistic missiles, Russia has also stepped up its campaign of airstrikes at cities far from the front line this summer. Ukraine has also increased its long-range attacks on Russian refineries and logistic infrastructure, aimed at undermining Moscow's war effort. Ukraine hit 4 logistic hubs owned by Russia's second-largest online retailer, Ozon, in southern Russia in drone strikes on Monday. Zelensky said on Saturday that Ukraine's war effort was complicated by a $27 billion defense funding gap this year. He also warned that Russian could look to mobilize some 300,000 additional troops after parliamentary elections in September. Paying tribute to the people and soldiers defending Ukraine in war, Zelensky called on allies to give it everything needed to stop the war. "We are not asking you to fight for us," he said, urging allies to bring Russia to the negotiating table and hit it with more sanctions. Zelensky said he hoped that the United States will lose all the contradictions and phobias regarding Russia. "China must no longer remain silent," he added. And also from Newsmax, Norway will continue developing its oil and gas resources in Barents Sea regardless of the European Union's support for a moratorium on Arctic hydrocarbon supplies and no longer sees itself as Europe's green battery, Energy Minister Tyrsha Ashland told Reuters. Following Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine, Norway has become Europe's largest supplier of natural gas, meeting around 30% of gas demand of both the European Union and Britain. Last year, the country's gas production was near record levels, while oil output reached its highest level since 2009. Officials' forecast, however, showed production falling sharply after 2030 unless new resources are discovered and developed. In today's geopolitical and security environment, and given the resource situation, I believe continued activity in the Barents Sea serves both Norwegian and European interests, Ashland said in a Reuters interview ahead of ONS, Norway's biannual energy conference, which begins in Stavanger on Monday. The European Union currently supports a ban on new drilling in the Arctic on environmental grounds, but is considering revising its policy in response to concerns about energy security. Anders Opedal, CEO of Equinor, Norway's biggest oil firm, said that oil and liquefied natural gas, the LNG, from the Barents Sea can be shipped anywhere in the world if rejected by the EU. The only thing that will suffer from this is actually European security. We have flexibility, Opedal told Reuters on Monday. Eschelen said Norway aims to maintain petroleum production and exports at roughly current levels until at least 2035, and Barents Sea production will be key. If Norway is to remain a long-term supplier of oil and gas to Europe, then the Arctic must be part of that discussion, the energy minister said. In talks with EU officials, Norway has argued that the parts of the Barents Sea open to petroleum activity are also ice-free like in the North Sea, and so less prone to oil spills and other environmental impacts, and are helping to sustain jobs and settlement in the country's northern regions bordering Russia. Ashland believes Norway's arguments are being heard in Brussels, but added that it was the country's sovereign right to develop the Barents Sea resources even if the EU continued to support a moratorium. We would develop these areas and then it will be up to the EU whether they should have the moratorium or on buying that gas or oil, Ashland said. The Arctic oil would be sold into global markets regardless, while gas could be exported worldwide as liquefied natural gas from Equinor's Molokoyaka LNG plant near Hammerfest, he said. International Energy Agency Executive Director Fatih Birol has also urged the EU to reconsider its opposition to new Arctic oil and gas developments, arguing that future supplies will be needed to support energy security. Critics of such a move argue that the new Arctic projects would take many years to come online and would do little to address Europe's near-term energy challenges. In addition to oil and gas, Norway produces a surplus of renewable energy most years from an extensive network of reservoirs and waterways feeding hydroelectric plants, which it has exported to Europe via cross-border power cables. Norway has previously presented itself as a green battery of Europe, but the minister says this idea is now outdated, as Norway alone can't balance the European power market. It was a flawed idea, Ashland said. The idea helped drive the construction of a new power interconnectors, including links to Britain and Germany, but has drawn some opposition in Norway as European electric prices have escalated. Deeper integration with Europe's power system left Norway more vulnerable to continental price swings. Aslan said Norway will not build new interconnectors, but remains committed to strong power section cooperation with Europe. He urged countries on the continent to strengthen their stable power supply, weakened by coal and nuclear plant closures, and lack of investment in new gas-fired generation. Doing so will lower prices and build greater reciprocity when it comes to power flows between different countries. The future lies in having a very strong and integrated system, Aslan said. And Shelley Fabre's Johnny Angel singer, actor in The Donna Reed Show and coach, dies at 82. Shelley Fabre's, an actor who was a fixture on television for decades from her days as a young teenager on The Donna Reed Show through One Day at a Time and Coach, has died. She was 82. She died Saturday in Los Angeles, her family said in a statement to the Associated Press. No cause was given. To her family and friends, Shelley was a source of love, strength, laughter, and comfort, her family wrote. She had a remarkable ability to make people feel welcomed, valued, and cared for. Fabre's was born in Santa Monica, California in 1944 and started acting as a young child. Her first television credit came at age 10 when she appeared in The Loretta Young Show. Many movies and television shows followed. She acted with Paul Newman, Frank Sinatra, and Eva Marie Saint in a producer's showcase production of Our Town, was in the Rosalind Russell movie The Girl Rush, and the Rock Hudson drama Never Say Goodbye. Other early credits include Annette, Captain Midnight, and the Black Leather Jackets episode of The Twilight Zone. Her biggest break came when she was cast as Mary Stone on The Donna Reed Show, where she was a regular from 1958 through 1963. During that time, she also got a recording contract and had two top 40 hits, including Johnny Angel in the early 1960s. She also co-starred in three movies with Elvis Presley, Girl Happy, Spin Out, and Clambake. I think the years on The Donna Reed Show, the years from 14 to 19, were so incredibly important, Fabre's told the Los Angeles Times in 1993. Donna Reed was simply an extraordinary woman, a woman of great strength, kindness, integrity, and compassion. I am not trying to make her sound like a saint, but she had the most profound influence on me. I carry her with me today. In the late 1970s, Fabre's made an impression on Francine Webster on CBS's sitcom One Day at a Time. She also played James Caan's wife in Brian's Song. One of her biggest roles came when she was cast as Christine Armstrong in Coach, although the show took a minute to find its audience. I did always feel from the very beginning that if they could find the right spot for us, this was the show that would last, she said in the 1993 Los Angeles Times interview. Fabre's married twice, first to producer Lou Adler in 1964. She'd been married to M. Ascaris A. Ascaris S. Ascaris H. MASH actor Mike Farrell since 1984. She was also a devoted advocate for Alzheimer's awareness, which affected her mother. In 1999, a visit to the emergency room for esophageal bleed revealed she had progressive liver failure. After spending 22 months on a waiting list, she had a liver transplant surgery in October of 2000. In an interview with Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles 3 years after the transplant, she said she'd been changed by the experience and was internally grateful to Farrell, who was with her every step of the way. Her family, in their statement, said, "We will remember Shelley for her kindness, loyalty, wit, courage, and beautiful spirit. We will miss her deeply, not only as a celebrated performer, but as a loving and extraordinary person she was in our everyday lives." Also from Newsmax, the Mexican governor indicted by the U.S. seeks leave again after contentious return to office. The embattled governor of Mexico's Sinaloa state has reversed his decision to return to his post, bowing to an extraordinary backlash from his own ruling party over accusations by U.S. prosecutors he conspired with a powerful cartel to smuggle drugs into the United States. Okay. State lawmakers were expected Sunday to approve Governor Ruben Rocha Moya's request for an indefinite leave of absence, about a day and a half after he announced his return by claiming Mexican prosecutors had cleared him of the drug trafficking charges leveled against him by the U.S. Department of Justice in late April. The rapid reversal demonstrates the authority Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum wields over her Morena party as she walks a fine line between placating President Donald Trump, who says cartels control Mexico, and has repeatedly offered U.S. military help to fight them, and her progressive movement deeply wary of U.S. intervention. After nearly 4 months on leave, Rocha Moya announced Friday he was returning to office, claiming Mexico's Attorney General's office had found no evidence to support our participation in any criminal conduct. He declared that he was back as governor of Sinaloa with my head held high. That defiance lasted barely a day, as his return unleashed a torrent of criticism from governors, senators, and other prominent figures in Morena, including Sheinbaum. No personal interest can ever come before the interests of the people and the nation, she wrote Saturday in an apparent rebuke of Rocha Moya. Without mentioning him by name, Mexico deserves public servants who understand that positions are temporary, but responsibility to the nation is eternal. Morena said its national leadership had no prior knowledge of Rocha Moya's return, calling it his personal decision. The party's Senate bloc urged respect for the ongoing investigation, while Morena governors declared in a joint statement that personal or group political projects had no place when the country's interests are at stake. Ricardo Monreal, Morena's leader in the lower house of Congress, publicly urged Rocha Moya, his longtime ally, to reconsider and remain on leave. The coordinated response left Rocha Moya isolated. He announced later Saturday that he had asked the state legislature to allow him to step aside indefinitely. Sinaloa, the nation, and the transformation movement comes first, he wrote. Rocha Moya had been on leave since early May, days after federal prosecutors in New York unsealed a bombshell indictment accusing him and 9 other current and former Mexican officials of protecting Sinaloa cartel members in exchange for bribes as they trafficked fentanyl, heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine into the U.S. The indictment marked the Trump administration's most significant public action against what it calls official corruption, enabling Mexico's cartels, fueling new tension between the U.S. and Mexican governments. Sheinbaum has denied shielding Rocha Moya, but rejected Washington's request to arrest and extradite the defendants without credible evidence, insisting that any prosecution take place in Mexico. Rocamoya, 77, a staunch ally of Sheinbaum's mentor, former President Andre Manuel López Obrador, denied wrongdoing and described the charges as a politically motivated attack. He initially stepped aside so he could cooperate with the Mexican investigation without relying on the constitutional immunity attached to his office. Whether taking leave stripped him of that protection, and whether his latest request to step aside indefinitely would do so again, remains disputed among Mexican legal scholars. After the indictment, the mayor of Culiacán, Sinaloa's capital, and the state's deputy attorney general also stepped down from their posts, while two former senior state officials surrendered to U.S. authorities. Sinaloa has been engulfed for nearly 2 years in a bloody conflict between rival factions of the cartel, and that bears the state's name. Also from Newsmax, Representative Sessions to Newsmax, GOP must emphasize contrast with the Dem leftist direction. Representative Pete Sessions told Newsmax on Monday that Republicans have a strong opportunity to retain control of Congress in November, but must make a forceful case for capitalism and what he called Americanism as Democrats move further to the left. The Texas Republican said on Newsmax's Wake Up America Early that the traditional start of the fall campaign season on Labor Day will renew focus on a midterm landscape he described as increasingly competitive. "Do I think that they can win both houses? No," Sessions said of Democrats. "I think that we're still really up for this." Sessions said Democrats embrace a more progressive policies could give Republicans an opening with voters, arguing the GOP needs to draw a clear contrast between its agenda and what he characterized as a Democratic Party increasingly socialist direction. "If we cannot tell Americanism the things that we have done, capitalism and the results against a bunch of communists, I would be very surprised," Sessions said. He pointed to Democrat candidates and activists embracing positions that he said should concern voters, including calls to abolish immigration and customs enforcement, expand government control, and impose additional gun restrictions. Sessions said Republicans should make those differences central to their midterm campaign strategy. "We do not want gun control. We do not want to open up our border. We are not for government taking private property," he said. The comments come as Democrats and Republicans prepare for a closely watched November election in which control of Congress is at stake. Democrats are seeking to take the House, with House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat New York, positioned to become a Speaker if his party wins the majority. Sessions also rejected the notion, that Republicans should enter into political negotiations with Jeffries ahead of what he described as a fundamental battle over the country's direction. Jeffries recently met privately with Jared Kushner, President Donald Trump's son-in-law and outside advisor, in a discussion that reportedly included housing, immigration, and the cost of living. Jeffries has indicated Democrats could work with the administration on issues where there is common ground, while insisting Republicans changed what he called "my way" or the highway approach. Sessions took a far more confrontational view. "I cannot imagine trying to sit down and have a peace talks before a battle like this," he said. "This is a battle over the soul of this country," Sessions added. arguing the election will help determine whether Americans continue to defend the Constitution and the country's existing political and economic system. The congressman also argued that Republicans must focus on younger voters, whom he said have become increasingly receptive to socialist ideas. Sessions cited comments he attributed to former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat California, about Democratic electoral trends, arguing that younger, more highly educated voters are moving further to the left. He said the trend reflects a broader problem with education and whether young Americans understand the principles underlying the country's political and economic system. The Texas congressman also addressed the state's closely watched Senate race between Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton and Democrat State Rep. James Tallarico, dismissing the possibility of a Tallarico victory, but warning Republicans not to become complacent. Sessions said outside political influences are changing the electorate, and that Republicans must actively remind Texans of the party's core positions. This requires Republicans not just to work together, but really to remind the Texas electorate that what we stand for, who we are, he said. And President Trump is heading to his golf course in Ireland to watch the Irish Open next month. President Donald Trump plans to visit Ireland next month to attend the Irish Open golf tournament at his golf course in Doonbeg in County Clare on the country's Atlantic coast, according to a White House official. Trump is scheduled to be in Ireland on September 12th and 13th. And will join an event with the U.S. Embassy workers and business officials before attending the golf tournament at Trump International Golf Links, Ireland, in Doonbeg, according to White House officials, who was not authorized to speak publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. Trump's course in Bedminster, New Jersey, hosted an LIV golf tournament in August. Another Trump course in Doral in South Florida is scheduled to host a PGA event, the Cadillac Camp Championship in March of 2028, and Trump has talked about his course in Turnberry, Scotland, hosting the British Open, which it did last in 2009, before Trump bought the resort. A return of the British Open to that property continues to face major logistical hurdles. Last summer, Trump went to Scotland for 5 days to golf at Turnberry and later inaugurated a new Trump golf course in Balmeady, Aberdeenshire. The White House refused to call that midsummer jaunt a vacation, but insisted it was a working trip. And Trump talked about trade with then British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Trump frequently travels to golf courses he owns in Florida and New Jersey, as well as a course in Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. But he is not known to take lengthy holidays. Don't take vacations. What's the point? He wrote in his 2004 book, Think Like a Billionaire. Trump's trip to Ireland will have him leaving the country right after he tries to rally support for Republicans in November elections, as the GOP holds its first ever national convention ahead of the midterm elections. The unusual event scheduled in Dallas on September 9th and 10th was Trump's idea to try to galvanize support by staging something similar to a convention both parties normally have before presidential elections. The trip was first confirmed by the New York Post. And CNN contributor Scott Jennings on Sunday downplayed reports that he is among the leading contenders to replace Carolyn Leavitt as White House press secretary, declining to comment on whether he is interested in taking the high-profile administration post. Jennings told CNN the State of the Union, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't have anything to say about this morning. He added that Leavitt is one of the best press secretaries in the modern era. CNN reported Thursday that Jennings, a longtime Republican political operative who worked for former President George W. Bush and advised Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, had emerged as an early favorite to succeed Leavitt. Jennings has been a prominent defender of President Donald Trump during the 2024 presidential campaign and throughout his second term, according to The Hill. He has frequently defended the president's policies and decisions during appearances on CNN and his radio program. His name has gained traction as the White House prepares for Leavitt's departure at the end of August. Jennings recently met with White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles at Mastro's Steakhouse in Washington, D.C., according to CNN. Multiple White House staffers reportedly believe Jennings has Wiles' backing in the search. Despite declining to discuss his own prospects, Jennings praised Leavitt and former White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who served in the role during Trump's first term. Whoever does that job has big shoes to fill, Jennings said. Leavitt, who has served as Trump's press secretary during his second administration, announced she will leave the White House at the end of the month. She said Friday that she'll return to Trump's MAGA Incorporated Super PAC, where she worked before joining Trump's 2024 presidential campaign. Trump has indicated that he is not rushing to choose Leavitt's replacement. CNN reported Thursday that Trump had told members of his team he wanted to take his time about the decision. Asked about Jennings, Trump offered a positive assessment. Scott Jennings is good, Trump said.